me tender.
Sailor!
Love me sweet. Never let me go. You have made my life complete, and I love you so. Love me tender, love me true.
Hi, this is Sam Furstenberg, director of the martial art classic American Ninja and the breakdance iconic movie Breaking 2 Electric Boogaloo. And you are listening to Grindhouse Messiah with Justin and Blaine.
Hey everybody, before we start this episode officially, we just wanted to chime in with a couple updates and news and notes. They're not necessarily the happiest of notes. This morning we both woke up to the news that Tobe Hooper was no longer with us. Blaine especially said that hit him pretty hard.
Oh yeah, it's been one of those people that throughout time has always been a major part of my taste and what I go for. Seeing movies like we all did with Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Life Force, and even Poltergeist. I just think it's one of those tough parts about getting older, because as we get older, unfortunately, our heroes get older too. So, lots of condolences and reach out to the family and hope everybody's doing all right.
Definitely, and there's no doubt in our mind that we're gonna have to do a Tobe Hooper episode. Not sure what that's gonna look like yet. There's so much interesting stuff to do with him as far as like. Segments in I absolutely love his segment in Body Bags. The Eye, that is so good. And then obviously Texas Chainsaw, which I have not seen since I was young, so we should probably do that to force me to rewatch that. Life Force, I love. There's a lot of stuff, but we'll definitely get an episode going on that, and I'm not sure when that'll be yet, but we'll definitely keep everybody posted. In addition, we did mention George Romero briefly a couple episodes ago, but we were going to do a whole George Romero episode that would have been coming out in the next week or two, and we decided to push that off. Why did we decide to push that off, Blaine?
Whoa.
You remember?
No.
No worry. Well, we did two reasons. One is we're really booked up, and we want to give him a proper episode, which still won't even remotely touch his legacy. But
I remember now.
Okay, and the other reason, besides we want to do it proper, is what is coming out in the next couple months?
Oh, man, I'm really excited about this. Arrow is getting ready to release the box set that's going to be covering all the films that were made between Dawn and Day of the Dead. So we want to be able to kind of celebrate that and memorialize them at that point.
Yeah, and so it's got some weird stuff on it, but we're not sure exactly which films from that set we'll cover. And Scream Factory also around the same time, I think in October now, is releasing Land of the Dead, which is one of the films we wanted to cover. So we'll wait for that special release, and we'll also dive into the Arrow box set. And so that will be our episode on Romero, probably coming somewhere in the November range, because I believe early November is when that box set drops.
Yes, so, I believe so. I think it's November 2nd.
Yeah, something like that. So that's perfect. So that'll be something you'll hear us talk about in November. I'm sure Romero will come up just in discussions between now and then, because how could he not? Same with Hooper. I can't imagine that you won't hear us talk about Hooper a little bit with Ryan Prowse, which we're going to be recording momentarily. So stay tuned. You won't have to wait for us to record that and all. You just have to listen to a couple of minutes of music, and then we're there. So thanks for tuning in, and we'll be right back after this brief musical interview.
Yeah.
back. Hope you all enjoyed the intro we had there and the music. This week we're going to be having on a very special guest, a gentleman by the name of Ryan Prowse, who directed a film that we all loved over at the Far Sighted called Low Life. How's it going, Ryan?
Hey, guys. How you doing? Thanks for having me on.
Oh, doing great, man. Thanks a lot for coming by. I know we were going to get into some movies that you picked, but first, do you mind letting everybody know a little bit about you and the movie Low Life that you made recently?
Yeah, definitely. I'll start off with a little bit of a humble brag that I'm currently sitting in the lobby at Fright Fest. We're playing here tomorrow, our time. So that's super exciting. And we're doing like a little mini European tour with the fest. We're playing Lestrange in Paris and Motel X in Lisbon and then Strasbourg. I get to tour around with the film, so I cannot believe my life right now.
No, that's amazing. And you had to be pretty stoked off that Roger Ebert review that came out.
Oh, yeah. No, we... I really thought the film was going to split the room a little bit more than it seems to have, where we've been getting really pretty unanimously good, you know, like reception. So that's really exciting.
Oh, no, absolutely. And with your movie Low Life, we're going to talk about it a little bit more in depth later. But what's kind of a little rundown on what it's about and everything from that side?
Yeah, it's a crime film. It's like there's a caper in the middle of where a woman's getting kidnapped, and then you kind of follow all sides of it. Her husband, luchador, you know, a masked Mexican wrestler who's a leg breaker for the mob as well. There's kind of two, like, there's an ex-con bozos that are the guys pulling the kidnapping, and then there's a motel owner who kind of has a past, and she's sort of kicks the whole thing off, sets it in motion, and then, you know, mayhem ensues. And it's sort of segmented up into, you know, different chapters of, like, you follow each side of the kidnapping.
No, absolutely. And yeah, I mean, it was a big favorite off of both myself as well as Doug Tilley, which unfortunately was going to join us but is having some real internet issues, but yeah, I mean, we both loved it, and I can't wait to talk about it a little bit more. With the movies that you did pick, which we're going to cover, you know, Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia, the Sam Peckinpah classic, as well as David Lynch's Wild at Heart, what was kind of the reason that you wanted to cover these movies especially, and how kind of they related to Low Life?
Yeah, it's funny, like, I rewatch them so we could kind of talk about them. I hadn't watched them since right before we were shooting the film. And I think, you know, definitely Bring Me Ahead of Alfredo Garcia. Like, I happened to just get a copy. I hadn't seen it for a couple of years, and I had to get a copy right before we were shooting. So I just feel like that's sort of the osmosis of, like, I think, like, the atmosphere of that film is incredible. Like, how sort of just nasty and sleazy, gross everything really feels, but like, it doesn't feel like it's put on, you know. I think we kind of took some of that with Low Life, and then with Wild at Heart, it's just sort of how he juggles so many different tones. And I think they, to the most part, like, all work, you know, where you're jumping from kind of comedy to, like, just super tragic, you know, one second to the next, which is really interesting to me.
Oh, yeah.
And we definitely tried to do that with the film, with Low Life.
No, absolutely.
Definitely. I've actually hadn't seen either Alfredo Garcia or Wild at Heart prior to recommending them. And the thing is, it's crazy, is that I really like Lynch a lot, so Wild at Heart's been on my to-do list for a while. And I have a copy of Alfredo Garcia I'm supposed to be reviewing for Synapse, and it's just been sitting here, and I keep forgetting that I got to do that. So I was like, well, perfect timing. So yeah. So I've been able to get to both of them, and I definitely saw the influence of both. I actually, and you know, not that my opinion matters, like somebody who writes for, you know, Ebert, but I prefer your film to either, so there you go. But
holy shit. Right, I'll take that.
Right? Yeah. But I did like both, and I especially liked Wild at Heart, but Alfredo Garcia, I think I had a discussion with both Blaine and Doug prior to us talking today, where I was saying that I think I just am not as familiar with Peckinpah as a lot of other folks, and I think the deal breaker for me was just how overtly misogynist his work is, and it kind of was tough to just like watch like there not be a single decent male in the movie, where they all just treat women like total shit. And so
100%. Well, and even it was funny. Like, even I totally agree. Like even watching them back to back, like. Again, like I said, I was just like, oh my god, the scene in Wild at Heart even with Willem Dafoe, like,
oh my god. I have notes on that scene, man. Oh my god.
Well, I was just gonna say, like, to me it was even like the it kind of caught me off guard, especially watching them back to back of it being like, god, this weird like a welcomed rape sort of thing, which is just not at all obviously the case. So I don't know, that was definitely kind of stuck out on this viewing. Which is, and I mean, yeah, Peckinpah is just straight up a piece of shit. Like I read an interview with him recently from an old Playboy interview or something, and he's just like, you know, talking about that and Straw Dogs, where he's just like going in on, you know, like rape stuff and like, yeah, just totally misogynistic. So there's no defending any of that stuff. That's terrible.
Oh yeah.
Well, and that helps to make that film feel so much easier too. You know, I mean, it is a very sleazy film.
Yeah, I think it's just, it's kind of unfortunate. Like I like the idea of like this danger sort of coming from anywhere, you know, especially at that moment in Alfredo Garcia. But you know, the way I just think, like, yeah, Peckinpah is just an idiot on that front, where it's just, and yeah, again, just like not a great dude, where it's like it's coming from her as opposed to, you know, the attackers, which is, and like really just like blaming her for it sort of thing, and
definitely,
you know. Yeah,
so before we get even deeper into Alfredo, just as a way of introduction to yourself a little bit more, just so listeners know, Low Life is your debut feature, is it not?
Yeah, this is my first feature.
Pretty awesome, man.
Oh, thank you.
And
thanks.
What was your experience in the film world prior to directing this film?
I went to AFI. A lot of or pretty much all of like the department heads of, you know, the entire film were, we all went to AFI together and graduated from. A lot of us did our thesis film, Narco Corrido, which we won a Student Academy Award. So that was kind of my first entree into the biz. And then from there, it was just, you know, like, so basically there are five writers on Low Life. And we all wrote stuff in school together, and we kind of started this, like comedy troupe called Tom Fondle, and we were doing like online sessions, and we did a web series, and then that's kind of how we were all working together writing stuff, and that led to this. And Low Life was initially, like I said, it was we chapter it up, but it initially we were putting it together as like a crime anthology film, just, you know, kind of a to get it done, but then also we all sort of had these little stories floating around that we wanted to do, and then as we were writing it became kind of clear. It was like, oh, this would be so much cooler if you sort of had them all overlap and start, you know, kind of smashing together. So that then became like, you know, how we changed the script.
Awesome. Well, Blaine, do you have any other, you know, introductory kind of questions before we start digging into Alfredo a bit?
No, all my questions we'll get to eventually once we start talking about these movies.
Okay, cool.
So, Alfredo Garcia, like I said, I was my first viewing. By way of those who haven't seen it or haven't seen it in a while, the short version of what the film is about is essentially this this girl's pregnant. She won't tell her dad who got her pregnant, so he decides he's going to put out a, when she finally does say, oh, it's Alfredo Garcia, yeah, you know, after he kind of violates her, which is, that's a whole other thing we'll get into, oh my god. But God, I'm just like rambling here. Let me try this one more time. Yeah. The point of the story is he wants to kill. Right, right. Holy crap.
Well, that's kind of, I feel like that's, I feel like that's, like, explaining Low Life as well. It's like, well, there's all of these things going on at the exact same time.
So. Okay, so let me try one more time. What I'm saying, and I probably won't edit that because it might be actually appropriate to leave in. Alfredo Garcia is this dude who got this girl pregnant, and the dad wants him dead. That's essentially it. We find out pretty early on that he is already dead, but our I don't want to call him hero, protagonist of the story, has to go venture to get the head to prove that Alfredo's dead, to make, well, he's offered $10,000, aside from the fact that it's actually, what, $1 million
right,
bounty. So these other guys are setting him up so they can make a lot more money. So that's kind of the setup for the film. But there's obviously a whole lot more to it. So, Ryan, just to start us off, you know, what about this film specifically? You did touch a little bit on this already, but what about this film besides the fact that Peckinpah is a douchebag? Did you actually like, and did you find, like, kind of as an influence to what you were doing with Low Life?
Yeah, I think, like, so with Low Life, like, the initial pitch to it was, like, you know, making a film about sort of these characters that are normally in the margins of other films. And, you know, Warren Oates is like an incredible character actor. Everyone knows who Warren Oates is, but he's so awesome. And, you know, like, he is the lead of this film, which he doesn't ever really get to do that. So that to me is really exciting, an exciting idea. And, you know, it's like, he's literally the piano player, you know, when they first find him, he's a piano player and it's like, little bar, which, you know, in every other movie he'd be like the guy who gives you the information, you move on or whatever, and we actually, like, the camera stays with him and we just start following his little, you know, part of this story, which again was just super exciting. The first time I saw it, I was like, you know, I'd seen Warren Oates and enough stuff that I was like, oh, okay, cool, he'll be like a cool supporting, like, oh my god, wait, he's the lead of this movie, you know. That was just a really cool surprise. So I think that's the big sort of takeaway from it. And then, yeah, just tonally, I mean, to be able to shift from kind of intimate character stuff between him and Ilsa, the female, I'll call her the protagonist. I mean, she literally kind of kicks the whole thing off. She knows the information of where Alfredo Garcia is because she used to date him. And, you know, it's more of like he's got to actually pull that out of her, which is really sort of gut-wrenching because it's asking her to, you know, betray her former lover, which is really cool. But anyways, yeah, so it's like, you know, you're following these two and there's these intimate moments and then there's some action stuff that kind of comes in and there's horror. And so it's just like playing with those, like, blending of, like, tone, genre, you know. I feel like we pulled a lot of that for Low Life.
Oh, and
that makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah, no, that makes perfect sense because a lot of when I was watching Low Life, it kind of had this combination of vibes where it kind of had this kind of Western kind of story combined with, you know, as well as, you know, action and exploitation. And you see so much of that played out in Alfredo Garcia, where you're going from these moments where it would make more sense if everybody was riding horses and they were going into the, you know, the 1900s, you know, the 1900 whorehouse. But it's so, I love that they decided to, you know, adopt this kind of this roaming car culture sort of thing along with Mexico. And yeah, see, for me with Peckinpah, I guess I've always given the guy kind of a pass because between this movie, Wild Bunch, and Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, I've just grown up loving these movies and being those kind of, you know, those dad movies that, like, you know, I won't let you watch rated R movies, but I'm gonna let you watch these horrifying westerns.
Yeah, these rednecks kill half of Mexico.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, it's like, hey, you know, we're not gonna watch that, but don't worry, we're gonna watch, you know, men slap around hookers for 2 hours. And yeah. but yeah, so I always grew up on him, and I always kind of, for some reason, Alfredo Garcia as always kind of, it overlaps in my head with another film that I love, Barraquero, by Gordon Douglas. I'm not sure if you're if either of you have seen it. I mean, that Warren Oates character, I feel like it's just like if he was born 100 years later, would have been that same guy that he is in both of those films, where he's just been dragged through the mud and just realized one day that he, that, you know, might makes right. And I don't know, man. Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia is, by the time you make it to about that halfway mark, it becomes a nearly perfect movie, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, I love the fact that, like, again, just, you know, like even you said from the sort of the intro of it, of I mean, it is like a full exploitation intro where it's like, you know, the boss, the jefe, like, orders this guy's death, and, you know, everyone's going to go out looking for him. There's a bounty on his head. You know, it's such a, like, an exploitation sort of staple. And then, you know, like, the next hour of that, we're just sitting in rooms with the two of them, kind of, like, talking about whether, you know, she wants to betray her former lover or not. So it just, it's such a cool, like, left turn that you don't normally see. And that, and seeing these type of films, I mean, obviously, like, exploitation stuff's kind of famous for, like, you know, hiding the ball and like, padding the time out or whatever. But, you know, I feel like it just, you start getting deeper into their characters, which is just so much more interesting to me than, yeah, it just being like a shoot 'em up or whatever.
Right. And with a lot of Peckinpah's movies, it is great how he takes the kind of those exploitation and like, B-movie tropes, but rather than padding them out, he kind of lets them meander and kind of breathe, you know what I mean? Especially that. And where you know, an exploitation movie, they would just, you would just watch someone drive for seemingly no reason. He kind of lets everything breathe, and you kind of just take in everything around you, and you kind of, by the end of it, man, I just feel like itchy and dirty by the end, because it's just dirt and flies everywhere.
The choice of his, like, white suit in the beginning that's just filthy by the end of it is so great. I mean, that's, like, everyone writes about that, but that really is just an incredible touch to that character, you know?
Oh, yeah, because by the end of it, you feel as exhausted as he is. You know, there's no hiding that at all. And Justin, I know you had a little bit more of a you were a little bit more torn on the film.
I think I was mostly torn on the fact that women are all treated like complete shit throughout the movie. I mean, honestly, that said, the main character, I think he wants to be better towards women, at least to its one woman, but he's just not. He tries a little, but he still sucks at it. You know, but that said, like, that aside, the thing that, I mean, from the tone from the beginning, you have this crime boss, and that's what got me tripped up in explaining the movie, is just the fact that, how is it, like, he can justify, yes, I'm not okay with someone impregnating my daughter, but I'm gonna have my goons rip off her clothes to embarrass her and humiliate her in front of a room of people, where she's standing there shamed and naked and pregnant.
Right, and I mean, and I think we'll talk about that a lot more with Wild at Heart as well. I think that a lot of that's just sort of that sadistic streak that does come from the filmmaker, and I can see why that would bother you.
Well, it doesn't bother me in Wild at Heart, though, which is interesting, because I guess because I'm more familiar with David Lynch, and so I'm expecting certain things. I don't know.
Yeah, I think, I mean, even with this, with Alfredo Garcia, I mean, I feel like the boss is, like, I mean, again, that's, like, Peckinpah's thing, where, like, I feel like, and this is my opinion on it, but, like he's obviously, like, molested her, right? Like, he doesn't know if it's even his kid or not, or he wants it to be his kid or something. Like, there's something, like, deeper between the two of them, or, like, that, you know, obviously that the boss, her father, is, like, sort of like pushing on her. So yeah, I don't know, there's that moment where he does rip her clothes off, but then she kind of, like, you know, straightens up and stands up against it, which is really it's like really hard. It's fucking terrible to watch, but you also are kind of like rooting for her in that moment of like, fuck, she's got, you know, a backbone here. And I love, even, you know, can we spoil a, what, 50-year-old movie, 40-year-old
yeah,
movie?
Yeah, we can spoil it.
I mean, like, you know, in the end when she's like, you know, kill him, like, she is the one that finally pulls the contract on him, which is, you know, a really great sort of reversal, which you wouldn't have if you didn't have her, you know,
right.
be well, no, and, kind of put down.
So I actually get the motive of why do it.
No, of course,
how,
yeah.
How horrible the boss, the father was. I also can't help but see that as inspiration towards the quinceañera killing in real life. Where,
well, and I mean, Teddy in general, you know, not to spoil a right. 1-year-old.
Well, I don't want
to
spoil you. But I just mean, and I won't get too deep into it, but just the fact that, you know, he has a shamed young gal, and by he, I mean Monstro, kind of, you know, give him some direction in a way. But you you kind of flip and reverse that a little bit too. So so we'll just leave it at that with that regard. But I do think there's a lot about this film that's really interesting. And I do think it's extremely well made. Like it knows what it's doing from beginning to end. I mean,
yeah, 100%.
Yeah, he knows the tone he's setting up with.
Well, and that's
you know, yeah. Go ahead.
I was gonna say I feel like he also. Like, this is the movie more than anything that he got to, like, really... I mean, it's almost autobiographical, so it's like, this is his movie more than, you know, the other one's got cut to hell, so it's like, mm-hmm. this seems like pure Peckinpah. So this is obviously a real glimpse into how, you know, how his mind works, good, bad, or, you know, however.
Yeah, because it's kind of interesting what Justin mentioned before, where... He's talking about Warren Oates' character in the movie where he seems like he's trying to be better than the dirtbags around him. And you kind of see that with the way Peckinpah does set up some of the scenes, especially when they meet up with the bikers, with Kris Kristofferson and you have Ilsa, she plays the guitar, and you have that, like, well, it seems like, oh, okay, we're going to get, like, a little tender moment. Then it just can't help but go dark, like, right. immediately after. But you have this, like, really brief, tender moment in the movie where it's like, well, okay, maybe things can be a little all right between the two of them. And then, but Peckinpah just, he can't help himself. And, I mean, I, like I said, good, bad, or indifferent, it's what it is in the movie. And I do agree with that, though. This is the Peckinpah movie. Compared to the others, you know, compared to Convoy. I don't know.
Maybe he did have a full... he had full control of Convoy by that time. Oh, not of his own facilities.
that would be probably one of the most amazing things if he was the... if that was his total control of Convoy, but...
That's his masterpiece, is Convoy.
Great song.
Yeah.
And to the Warren Oates character, which I keep calling Warren Oates, what's his name? I don't even freaking remember.
Benny.
But Benny. To Benny being at least attempting to be a better person, you know, there are points where he consoles his lady love, where he really does kind of, you know, have those better sides of him come out. Like when she's in the shower crying and he comes and consoles her.
After the rape.
Well,
even with that, I was going to say that is cool where, like, it's still, to me, that is, like, it's you can just see the intention of the filmmaker more almost, I would say, than the character, where it's like,
right.
even then he's saying, oh, like, Benny is lovable and we can kind of get on his side because he's willing to overlook the fact that she got raped and there he still loves her, you know? So
yeah, he's willing to overlook the fact that he,
yeah,
you know, whatever. Yeah. Oh, I hear you.
That in that shower scene, like I was struck this time. I hadn't noticed this before, but you know, I mean, maybe we're, you know, I don't know. I feel like there's multi facets to it, which is interesting. Like, where he shot the way he shot that, like, he uses, like, a super wide lens for all of Warren Oates' close-ups, and he looks, I mean, extra ghoulish. Like, it almost looks like, it reminded me of, like, you know, like, that Simpsons episode where Mo comes over to date Marge or whatever, and they show him looking through, like, the eye hole, and he's just, like, grotesque monster, you know, and then, like, all of her stuff is shot over his shoulder, kind of on a longer lens, and she's a lot, you know, she's lit pretty. So, I don't know, there's something to that still where it's, like, is, you know, he still wants you to know that this guy's, like, as much of a monster as everybody else, too. And it is, right. Like, no one's good in the fucking movie, basically.
Yeah.
No man's good in there.
Yeah, no man's good. I mean, I think she's mostly good. I mean, obviously, she's not perfect either, because she just spent a couple days fucking around on her man with Alfredo Garcia right before.
Man, we don't get to meet Alfredo Garcia. He might be just fucking, he may have been, like, the best dude. And he dies before the movie starts.
Yeah. You know, well, I mean, well, we do know that he definitely has a lot of women that are all about.
Yeah, you but know, the good guys are all dead so. by the time this movie starts.
Oh,
that's
man.
I like that now. That's what I'm going to go with.
Yeah. Well, and you know, and that kind of ties into one of the things. I saw this film being extremely influential to, you know, the post exploitation kind of folks that are out these days in Hollywood, you know, the Rodriguez Tarantino ilk. You know, I'm watching this film and, like, I can't help but and I wrote here, every time he's driving with Alfredo's head in the car and talking to him, I'm like, oh, I'm watching Sin City.
yeah, definitely.
And I can't help that. And then, like, and Blaine and I even talked about that a little bit ago. And then, you know, in addition to that, what you just said is, like, all the good people die before the movie. Well, that's basically, you know, Hateful Eight right there. And
yeah.
Every decent human being's dead before the movie starts.
Tarantino just took it one step further with A Horrible Woman as well. He also added women being just as bad.
I was like, by the way, she's as horrible as the rest of them. yeah, definitely. You know, but I do like the end. I like the come on, Al, we're going home, you know, and just you know, I do appreciate kind of where it all went, and there's definitely a lot about this movie that I think will be reward rewatches, even though I didn't love it initially. Where I think there's certain things about it I want to kind of go over again. And
well, even I think that's a great point of, like, even just, I mean, these aren't my favorite movies, but they are movies I keep coming back to. So that is, like, super, you know, interesting to me of, like, even, like, something like another one of my favorites now is Killing of the Chinese Bookie. Like, the first time I saw that, I was like, oh, that's interesting. But it's those things that, like, stick with you are almost kind of more exciting than the things that are either instantly, like, turn you off or turn you on, you know?
Oh, and that's a great comparison, because Cassavetes' films are kind of like that too, because I remember I saw that when I was way too young, and I was a teenager, I didn't know shit about life, and
yeah.
And I was like, okay, I guess that's good, they tell me this is a good movie, you know, and kind of moved on. Then as I got older, you know, revisiting it, yeah, no, I man, that is a I think a really apt description.
Yeah, and those, like, I mean, and that's, I think, I mean, obviously as a filmmaker too, like these movies, you know, I do take stuff out of them that, like, or take away stuff from them that I kind of can, like, steal or use or whatever that, yeah, it may not be, again, like, my favorite movie ever, but I mean, like, because Wild at Heart is fucking weird. Like, I hadn't watched it in a while, like I said, and I rewatched it recently, and I was like, man, I forgot how just, like, all over the place that movie is, but it's great, but it is one of those, like, I can't imagine. And I was doing a little reading of, like, I mean, I think it did definitely, like, sort of split the room at Cannes when it premiered, but because it won Palme d'Or, right? But it like, people were booing it when they went up to, like, accept it or whatever. Like, that's awesome, man. That's so crazy, you know?
Yeah, because that's one of my favorite stories, because you walk away, you're like, okay, it won Palme d'Or that year, but you go through the reviews in 1990 when it came out, and it's not that well received, at least at the time. It definitely, I mean, I think it took everything that everyone had been seen with Lynch, who kind of became, you know, kind of a, like, an art house darling for a while, And I think it just, like, betrayed everybody by making this ultra-violent, ugly. I mean, because it's an ugly movie, especially compared to, like, Blue Velvet, which is, you know, it's not, like, that's not, like, a fun movie, but it's way uglier and way just sleazier.
Yeah, definitely.
And since we're transitioning into Lynch, we're talking in Wild at Heart here, looking at... You already touched on one of the things that was most impactful about that movie to me, which is Willem Dafoe. Willem Dafoe is so fucking sleazy and horrifying.
Oh, that's incredible. That's such a good character event. I mean, we joked, like, our villain, Teddy Bear Haynes, we joked he's like, you know, the nephew of Bobby Peru or something.
Yeah, he doesn't have the suave, but to be fair, Bobby Peru, once you get him in a room, he just, that swap disappeared real quick. it struck me specifically because I believe that Frank from Blue Velvet might be the scariest monster on any film ever made.
100%.
He just horrifies me. And that's part of why I think that movie's so good, is he's just so horrifying. And I was like, what is it about David Lynch that he's able to come up with the most horrifying, sexually deviant monsters? Like Willem Dafoe isn't in the film nearly as much as, you know, Frank is in Blue Velvet, but his scenes are so impactful.
Yeah.
So impactful.
Yeah, and there is that, like, and it is, I feel like, because it's, you know, like Eraserhead type stuff, where it is just this dread, like, that's built into everything, and it is that kind of uncomfortable, like, you know, you're at, like, a friend's house and their dad is, like, you know, giving just the fucking sickest vibes, and you're like, what is going on? This is so weird, you know? So, and you're just on edge. It just always feels like, so it's weird friend's dad on edge vibe is what he's always having into, I think.
Oh, yeah. What really unnerves me is between the sound design and the soundtrack, because you've got, like, that weird drone that goes the whole time throughout the film, and then out of nowhere it's just death metal, where it's like it's a world where, like, just death metal is what people is, like, the equivalent of pop music, and I don't know why I think that's so funny, but it, like, every single time, it just tickles the shit out of me, and I love it.
I like when they put on the death metal song "Pull Over" and just fucking rage on the side of the road.
Yeah,
it's like man, that's so perfect. I need to do that on my way home from work after a long day. You know, like, just,
yeah.
Oh,
it's like the full Badlands dance song dance number.
Yeah, because and with your film, kept noticing was, while that, both movies kind of feel like they kind of follow that vignette style, where you've got a lot of things that are seemingly disconnected that eventually do come together at kind of a nexus point. And with Wild at Heart, a lot of them just don't go anywhere. I just think this movie is kind of a lot of just cool ideas with David Lynch, and not real concerned about everything kind of making its way around. But I definitely noticed that, where your film, you know, compared to a Lynch movie, is a lot tighter, and where things do come together. But it is one of those strange things in this movie where you have a lot of things that get introduced that just never pick up or go any direction at all. But you just love those moments.
Yeah, I was thinking about that too, of like, because it was right around, wasn't it, like, in the middle of him doing Twin Peaks as well. So it's almost like he was in that mind state of, like, oh, okay, we're going to introduce these threads that, like, in a TV show you'd maybe follow, which, I mean, he did that in Twin Peaks too, that, like, they just introduce stuff that goes nowhere too, so, you know,
right.
It's just his vibe, I don't know, but yeah, that is really, that is a kind of a cool little twist, and yeah, I don't know, it's like, you get a little something for everybody, I guess, that way.
Right. Yeah, because, and it's so funny to think about how people kind of view Wild at Heart, I mean, at least from on the side of on the critical side, everything like that, where it doesn't get quite as much love, but then 10 years later you get Mulholland Drive, that does basically kind of the same recipe, And, you know, it's always the list of, you know, the best movie of the 2000s. So it's kind of interesting to see, like, just in the context of time, where a movie that's just as strange and just as disconnected, how it kind of changes with the audiences.
Yeah. Maybe that's so Wild at Heart prepped everyone for Mulholland Drive.
Right. It was the primer.
Because Lost Highway is kind of like Mulholland Drive 1.0 sort of vibe, right?
Yeah, that's a movie I haven't seen for a really long time.
I haven't seen it since it came out. Like, I didn't super like it, but I was also, you know, a teenager. So, as you said, you're an idiot and you don't know life, so I should probably check that one out again.
Yeah, no, I've had it since. I picked it up on DVD about 2 years ago and still have not made it around to watching it again. But watching Wild at Heart, which I hadn't seen for probably 10 years, it makes me want to go back and check out a few of those Lynch movies that just don't come up in my mind as much.
Yeah, but I agree.
Definitely,
Blue Velvet's the jam.
Yeah,
it really is. and obviously, you know, I can go on about Twin Peaks because we've been watching. My wife and I are obsessed with the new show, which leaves me both excited every Sunday and dreading every Sunday because I know he's gonna like. He's going to tie together, like, one little thread and open 10 more.
Right.
And then just be like, oh, by the way, fuck you, the episode's over.
Life doesn't explain itself. Fuck it. I'm tired of it.
It's true. But yeah, so for anyone who hasn't seen Wild at Heart or isn't as familiar, the basic gist here, right, is that this guy, Sailor, you know, is in love with his I guess at the time movie starts she's probably only like 18.
Yeah.
And why am I going blank on her name? Lola.
Laura Dern.
Laura Dern. It's Lola, I guess is what her name is, right?
Lula. Yeah.
Lula. Yeah. That's it. Lula.
Lula, yeah, and Sailor.
Lula and Sailor. Some interesting
forever.
And so they go to a concert, see a metal band, of course, and then he has this guy try to kill him because the guy was hired by Lula's mom, and he blacks out, goes apeshit, and kills a dude, basically, which is a nice little, you know, reminded me a little bit of having just watched this right after I watched Low Life, you know, Monstro's blackouts.
The rage is...
Yeah, those rages were very similar in a lot of ways.
Those Nicolas Cage rages is what we were referencing. Yeah. All
right, so you tell the actors, so this is where you have a cage rage.
Yeah, exactly.
Awesome. Oh, that's awesome. And so then basically he goes to jail, he comes out, he gets back together with Sailor, and they go on a journey. It's a road movie, and obviously a whole lot of crazy shit that people are trying to, you know, chase him and kill him and yada yada.
And, yeah, I realized this time too, really they're like the road movie thing where like they never catch up with them. Like the mother, all her machinations, none of that comes into play at the end, right? They're just
no.
Then they go rob a bank. It's like what the fuck.
and I love that his plan to get him is let's rob a bank, which the whole time I'm thinking, I mean. It just sounds like the most probably the worst way to kill somebody off is by committing a crime with them. Especially when
and then shooting them anyways. Like you're gonna shoot them regardless.
Right.
But this is all dream logic. It doesn't matter.
No, and that's what's cool about it is because at the end of it, none of it really matters. It's just kind of if you had a good time, you know, because. I love, especially with like all the side characters that just get become, you know, major players out of nowhere. People, you know, being able to see like Calvin Lockhart pop up, you know, as like the Louisiana hitman, and you know, and you know the guys that just hang out at the motel. I mean, to me, those are the things that I really remember more than even the story after I watched that movie.
Right. Yeah, definitely.
And Isabella Rossellini playing both characters.
Yeah, because right, and it has a bunch of, you know, the good old Lynch stalwarts, you know, the Laura Dern and Harry Dean Stanton, Isabella Rossellini, Cheryl Lee, you know, there's a lot of folks, you know, When you have Laura Palmer as Glinda the Good Witch, that ain't bad, right?
You know, right. So,
that's the scene that kind of I always gravitate, but that, like, when they find her on the side of the road is, like, so incredibly moving that, like, that just comes out of nowhere, and you're like, oh my god, I'm in a real movie, like, out of nowhere. So
yeah,
god,
he grounds it with some weird stuff, and then he proceeds to bring in a vision of a witch. It's dream logic with some kind of weird little anchors into reality to remind you that it isn't all weird. There is some real shit going on.
And I feel like that like underlines it so much more and makes it so much more powerful is that, like, you think you know where the movie is tonally, and then it becomes like you watch somebody really, it feels like she's really dying and they're really reacting to it. You know, that was definitely something we took for Low Life as well, of those tonal shifts sort of thing. Like, it could be super funny 1 minute and then, you know, horrible the next minute.
Right. Well, and that's a really fair point. I think that was one of the things that jumped out at me, to me, as being extremely likely influential to you, is the way they handle the tonal shifts in this movie reminded me of the way your tonal shifts work too. You know, when you go your story to story and scene to scene, the tones definitely shift. I mean, and you've got, even within the individual stories, though, they have those tonal shifts too, because, you know, when you really think about it, right, in real life, we can go from super serious to having fun back to super serious, like, pretty quickly too. So it's all completely logical as long as you do it right, you know?
Yeah, that's obviously the challenge of even, I mean, like, you know, like, when we were even talking about the script or reading the script or working with the actors beforehand, it was like, okay, is this even going to, or, like, you know, is it too much of a audience whiplash to just be jumping into something? But yeah, I agree. It's like, that is the stuff of life
right.
You're just jumping around tonally, and it is a little bit of a trick to make it work in a movie so that you're not, like, you know, totally taken out of it. But yeah, I don't know, that was always, like, a really exciting part of the process to me, or the challenge of it, I guess.
Well, definitely. And the other thing that, you know, I have a couple specific scenes that jumped out at me, because, like, I actually started my day of watching all these films with your film, and then I saw, you know, in Wild at Heart, a couple of scenes specifically that jumped out at me as being, like, probably influential to you, whether consciously or not. When they're about to commit the bank robbery, there's classical music playing, just like when you know, Teddy's driving up with his freaking music right as he's about to bust in during his segment, and I'll just leave it at that. You know, as well as the shootout at the end there reminded me of a lot in the shootout in your film, in some of the ways it unfolded. So I thought that those scenes, which were back-to-back kind of scenes in both films, kind of reminded me a lot of the way you guys kind of did that as well. So
yeah, I love, like, and Wild at Heart, like, obviously Willem Dafoe's, like, super grotesque, but I mean, shot of him in his like with the pantyhose over his head or whatever, like that weird close-up of him, I love that, where he's just like grinning for like, and it holds way too long. It's like, what are we doing here? We're obviously just reveling in how nasty this looked. Yeah,
it looks so nasty. I'll bet you it wasn't even necessarily going to be that long until he got that picture and he's like, oh man, you look awful, I love it.
Yeah. but yeah, it was like, I think, like, there's, like, that balance of, like, you know, finding, like, movie moments or whatever that are, like, don't feel natural, but you have to hold on them, you know? And there was, like, trying to find those little moments in Low Life as well where it's like, well, this doesn't make sense to just sit here, but it's a movie and we need to have those, like, big moments there, you know?
Oh, yeah, because that kind of transition, it helps, you know, kind of accentuate the rest of what's going on. And, man, I think you guys really nail it with Low Life.
Cool.
And so let's move into Low Life. And since we've kind of already hit a lot of little things, I'm not going to, you know, be spending a lot of time on plot points because nobody, not a lot of people have seen it, so I don't want to ruin anything because it's a hell of a movie. But there's definitely a lot of things that that I have notes on and thoughts about. But I think that initially one of the things that I see or question I guess I have for you is what gave you the idea to involve ICE? Because I thought that was really interesting to start off the movie with a piece of shit ICE officer, and then how that all kind of unfolded later. Was that kind of in any way based on a lot of the weird current event stuff that's gone on for the last few years with ICE, or is that, you know, what kind of sparked that for you?
Yeah, it was definitely, I mean, like, ICE is just terrible, and they have, like, sort of, like, I don't think a lot of people know, like, how much carte blanche they have of, like, I mean, they are basically little strike teams that, like, go around towns and just straight up arrest people. I mean, it's crazy. They just, like, take people out of schools or out of their homes or whatever, so it's, like, just terrifying to me, you know?
Right. So, and to see them corrupted the way they were, I think seems really, really realistic because I don't think, because you have these little strike teams, it doesn't seem that unrealistic to then to get one of those teams to kind of work for you if you're a well-to-do mob boss, you know?
Yeah, I mean, they have no real checks and balances, which is obviously, like, the big problem with it. And I think, like, I mean, obviously, I mean, we shot this in the beginning of 2016, and we were writing it in 2015, so, I mean, we could not have ever, you know, I never in my wildest nightmares ever would I thought, you know, we'd be in a Trumpian junta America. So I didn't, but obviously I feel like that stuff was kind of just in the air of, like,
mm-hmm.
I mean, just that nastiness, you know, was kind of going around. So, yeah, I don't know. It just felt like, because there was kind of a discussion even early on of, like, is anyone going to know who ICE is or whatever, but it just felt like, you know, well, this is one of those things where maybe it's just a little detail that people will pick up later, or if you know it, you know it, cool. But it was just, it felt like you're saying, the most authentic sort of choice for, like, who would be going and arresting people. And it was actually kind of interesting. It's like a funny anecdote. Like, we were, that motel that we were shooting at was like a working motel. And speaking of male violence against women, like, it must be like the theme of this podcast. There was, like, a guy was, like, beating his girlfriend in the motel. We had to call the cops. And it was when we were shooting that intro scene of him walking in. And so the cops arrest the guy. You know, we're, like, giving statement, all that stuff or whatever. And then he's kind of hanging out while we were shooting, like, a couple takes. And I was, like, you know, we got kind of, like, free advice where I was just, like, is this how this would go down? And he was, like, yeah, the guys would probably take off as soon as he opens up the door and walks them out. But otherwise, yeah, you're pretty accurate. So that was a nice simpatico sort of thing.
Mm.
Yeah,
the tragedy of life.
Yeah.
And while we're talking about the villains, I was really curious, how did it play out linking up with Mark Burnham to play the main baddie in the movie?
Yeah, I loved Wrong Cops.
Yeah, that's where I know him from as well.
I actually saw that before I saw Wrong, so I didn't even know he was playing the same character in that, but I saw those shorts that they were putting on originally, and yeah, he just came in to read, but, like, it was hysterical. Like, I was totally, like, fanboying on him as soon as he walked in. I was like, yo, what is up, dude? And he was kind of, like, taken aback. Like, it's just like, I love Wrong Cops, man. You got to do this movie. So it was cool. It was, like, pretty quickly. I actually, like, you know, we talked, and then I showed him my short, and, you know, kind of went from there. But he was like, it then became kind of tailoring it around, telling the character around him. Like, we were just talking about this, we had initially kind of seen him more, that character more as like a, like, I saw him more as like a sort of like stereotypical kind of like shark skin suit wearing sort of dude or whatever. And then we were kind of like, well, LA's not really like that. And, you know, it just became like, let's get him in, like, knockoff Versace and, you know, bad knockoff opera music he blares out of his Miata, yeah, his Mazda Miata.
Oh, yeah. And with as exaggerated as some of those features are, it ends up being so exaggerated that it feels real. But it also kind of reminded me of a lot of kind of, especially like in blaxploitation movies, where you would have the evil white guy that would show up. It reminded me.
Oh, that was
me.
Like our, yeah, that's a really cool take. That I hadn't really thought of like the blaxploitation stuff, but that was a big rule from sort of jump, was like the white guy's the villain in this movie because fucking that's where we're at. So yeah. That had to be the case.
No, absolutely. And, oh man, it was great seeing him because I had only really seen him with Wrong Cops and Wrong, and man, it was great seeing him show because I mean he's legitimately scary throughout that movie, whereas he's so goofy and strange in the comedies.
Well, that's why he's such a. It's cool because he's such a physical presence. Like, I mean, he's just a huge, towering sort of guy. So you wanted, like, you know, I kept equating it to like we needed the Darth Vader to, like, you know, for everyone to kind of go against. But in that, he is still hysterical as well. So there is that kind of like, you know, dangerous clown sort of thing that, like, it's you're kind of like put off by.
Dangerous clown. Don't we have one of those in the White House?
Yeah, there we are.
Actually, maybe a few, well, to be honest.
It was funny, like, even, and again, this is sort of like that weird, like, you know, it was in the air or, yeah, you know, something just worked. But it was like, I remember Mark, like, even saying right before we're about to shoot, he was like, I want to do, like, can I cut my hair a certain way or whatever? And when he was talking about it, it kind of sounded like, you know, the hipster, like, Nazi cut, like the Hitler or whatever. And I was like, well, don't do the Nazi youth thing. He's like, no, I'm just gonna do like a little shave up underneath. But anyways, the way it like lays on his head, it looks straight up like Trump. He has like a weird
his hair is rat very hair. yes
it's pretty hysterical. I don't know. Yeah, nothing you could plan, but I'm glad it happened.
Right, and when I was going through the movies from Fantasia to review, I was going through the press pictures, and the first one of the first ones I saw was that photo with him with the machine gun and that awful shirt and the gold chain. I was like, oh, I gotta see this fucking movie.
Yeah, there's some I don't know, the costumer, our costumer, Alicia, she was like incredible. Like, she just sort of put, I mean, yeah, Monstro's costume, everything is just, you know, she killed all that stuff. And like, really smartly sort of like kind of planned out, like, you know, color stuff as well. There's just a lot of like really cool storytelling in those moments that you don't really, I don't think you pick up on consciously, but they do help kind of really inform the story, which is, it was exciting to kind of see come to life, you know?
Oh, absolutely.
Like the first day we shot some of, we had Monstro, and that was my first time seeing him fully. Like, I'd seen photos of him in the suit, and I'd seen photos of the mask. I hadn't seen it all together, and he just walked out of the room, and I was like, oh my God, it looks like a walking cartoon. You know, it's just so bright, and it's a really cool, you know, like, contrast to like how gnarly the rest of the movie looks. Like, it's just really, I don't know, it was very arresting even on set, so I knew that kind of stuff would really pop, you know, photos-wise and stuff. I mean, image-wise.
Right, because the imagery, I mean, just putting it out with the press and everything like that is, I mean, it's pretty iconic already. I mean, and those costumes, there's a lot said in when you see everyone who shows up and just how they're put together and everything like that, where you get to skip a lot of that that background info because it's already there.
Yeah, Nikki was really who played Crystal, Nikki Michaud. She was like, she really pushed for that. Like, I was kind of not into the smock thing initially, you know, like, she owns this motel and she was like, no, I want the smock. And we were kind of going back and forth on it for a while, but like, it's incredible where, you know, the moment where she like, and we kind of figured that out on set on the day, the moment where she like stuffed shotgun shells in her maid smock, I was like, well, fucking, that's incredible. Like, we I don't know what else to say to that. That's just that works.
She was incredible. I absolutely loved her in this movie.
Yeah, we we did the short together, and like she that Narco Corrido, and she like I mean we built the movie around her pretty much because it was like. You know, I had to figure out how to work with her again. She's seriously just like one of the, I mean, just elevates everything. One of the best actors I've ever seen, let alone work with. It was, we're like, I'm constantly just trying to figure out, okay, what's the next thing me and Nikki can work on together? Because she, like, just brings it. And she's such a, I don't know, it was really cool to see, like, you can check out Narco Corridos online as well. It's like, that was my thesis short. And that she plays a cop, like a border cop, and she's like, you know, such a, again, big physical presence in that. And then like in this film in Low Life, she was like, I don't know, she just transformed into this like meek, you know, sort of different, entirely different human being in front of my eyes. It was extraordinary to like actually just sit back and watch her like become a different person. It was,
but once Crystal breaks out of her shell, man, she breaks out of that shell.
Oh, like a motherfucker. Well, I mean, you know, our joke is always just get a shotgun in Nikki's hands and you got a movie.
Nice. Speaking of characters I really like, I'll introduce the next one I wanted to mention with a quote, which is, ma'am, call me a Nazi ain't cool. You don't know my struggle. Randy, man, that character is freaking. There's from the way it's performed to the way the character's written, I just love. I love, you know, the extremely urban white dude who grew up in the city, probably amongst all black friends, and then he goes to jail, and in order to survive, he gets a freaking swastika tattooed on his face. I mean, it's incredible. It's incredible. Like, I don't even know what to say about it. It's just so incredible. And obviously, I'm not gonna in any way ruin his story, but his end is perfect. His end is perfect. So
yeah, we kind of it's funny like we, and yeah, I don't want to ruin it either. But we kind of came around to that as we were writing it. We were like, oh wait, this is how this has got to end. Like that kind of came out of the writing process because it was just like this is too perfect to not write now. Like we have to do this.
Yeah, and as over the top as he looks when he's introduced, we all know a guy just like that. That's what I love 100%. About it. Yeah, because I was like, man, I know that guy. I know exactly who this guy is, and I loved it. That whole part, to me, like picked up and kind of kicked the movie in like overdrive for me, where I was like, okay, you had all this heavy stuff, and then once we got there, I loved it because it kind of got me laughing, you know.
Well, and that was like. Such a cool, like, finding that balance of, like, and I do like that part of, like, you know, Monstro's segment, you know, we're kind of there, and then Crystal's segment is just, like, the worst day in anyone's life ever, and then, you know, you have to, like, and I think that kind of comes right at the midpoint of the film, so it's, like, like, everybody's ready to laugh, and then, you know, then you have to laugh at a guy with swastika tattoo on his face. You're like, well, fuck, should I be laughing at this? I don't know.
Well, in the balance of the laughter, though, as well as, like, you know, he actually really kind of takes the reins and becomes a really important figure in the film then. And that's kind of awesome because you look at him and he's obviously got a clownish appearance because of this ridiculous tattoo and even, you know, talking like he, you know, like he's in a, I don't know, a member of 311 or something. And
he's got the bag. He's got the 98 Slim Shady baggy tracksuit.
He's basically Slim Shady with the swastika on his face. That's totally.
Yeah, cool. I mean, and that was Johnny the actor. John Oswald. I don't know his middle name, but I think he uses his initial for John M. Oswald. He loves Eminem and like was just he's like I'm doing you know the Video Music Awards whatever 2001 Eminem. He like had the specific Eminem.
That's
he was doing.
Hilarious. Was like, and awesome. It was like the way he talked, everything. It was just perfect and like and yet, you know, like I said, he's an awesome character because he takes shit seriously when he needs to then, and really, he's awesome. And then, of course, the only other character, well, characters we didn't really touch on, being Kaylee and Monstro. And, you know, Kaylee's an interesting character in her own right, mostly the victim of the story, but she definitely is more than just that. And then Monstro, that performance is pretty amazing as well. I mean, I don't know what Ricardo Zarate's face looks like because I've only ever seen, but I know that he did a hell of a job in that role, and I absolutely love that.
Yeah, I mean, huge kudos to him, because, I mean, yeah, acting behind the mask the entire film, that's incredible. You know, he we were really worried about that, like, even in kind of the design of the mask, was like, how can we get as much out of, you know, his face as possible? But he, I don't know, he didn't even need it. He just kind of, like, really embodied that character, and it was funny, like, he did, you know, his opening monologue was what he auditioned with. And, like, everyone that we'd seen, we were kind of, like, laughing
up. Hello?
Did we lose you?
Like, snickering up. When
hey, wait, Ryan, hold on one second. I think we lost
you. Laughing.
I got you in and out a little. Are you there?
Hello? Yeah.
All right. Hello? Okay, we got you. Hey, yeah, we couldn't hear you for a minute. Let's go back to just explaining him doing the opening monologue, because I kind of lost you in the middle of that.
Okay. Yeah, he Ricardo came in and auditioned with the opening monologue from his scene, and when everybody else was auditioning, we were kind of all laughing. Just because it's, you know, it's a pretty funny, like, he's telling his life story, but it's, like, super absurd, as a life story of a luchador would be. And when Ricardo did it, like, no one was laughing. We were like, oh, man, if you laugh, you're laughing at this guy's face of his life, if you're laughing at him. And he just was so, like, serious and grounded and, like, got it immediately, where he was like, oh, no, you play this, like, you know, you believe every word you're saying. And it's almost like he brought this, like, civility of almost like a knight or something. Like, he just acts like this sort of, you know, like he is kind of what you're saying with Warren Oates' character, like, he's from another time, you know, and kind of just in this world now. And we found out later on, he was telling me, like, when we were shooting, he was Mr. Mexico. He was like a champion bodybuilder in Mexico. His father and his older brother were also Mr. Mexico, so he, like, totally got the lineage thing. Like,
oh, man, so he totally had no choice but to understand that character.
Yeah, exactly. No, I was like, oh, okay, so you're El Monstro then. Great. That's incredible.
And, I mean, are you a fan of those, of, like, you know, like, the Santos and Blue Demon movies? Or
No, I love those, like, I mean, yeah, like, we were talking about this before, a buddy of mine, but just like, yeah, a guy, like, you know, in a full suit and a mask eating a steak, and then he gets up and, like, goes and fights, like, the mummy or the werewolf or something like that. It's just right. So good, you know, like, I love those movies. Yeah,
because I was crazy.
At Fantasia, they were giving Mil Máscaras a Lifetime Achievement Award or something, and they showed one of those films, and it was him and Blue Demon and El Santo, like, I think, fight, like, the She-Mummy or something. It was, like, I was just like, oh, my God, this is so good. These are back. We played back-to-back with the Mil Máscaras movie.
No, that's awesome. Yeah, because I've got a 7-year-old son, and we got on a kick a few years ago watching through all of those, and, yeah, they are so bizarre. I mean,
like, they really are.
It's like wrestlers just doing day-to-day activities, and then, you know, fighting a bunch of zombies and and voodoo priestesses. You know, like,
yeah.
And they just live their lives with the masks on, like, the whole time.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. The whole thing is that they
Why
don't
have
take
I not
the mask
watched
off.
Any of these? Whoa.
This, oh, they're so is... good. Well, and then get the Walmart 80 film box set for $19.99.
I guess I'm gonna have to do that, man. Ooh.
Yeah, man. You can find it in that old people section at Walmart where they got, like, episodes of Andy Griffith. They've always got Santa some blue demon movies.
Oh, man. I know exactly what you're talking about.
Oh, man. Yeah, and those are really, and I mean, even just that wrestling is so cool of, like, and they do protect, like, that tradition of, like, I mean, I'm sure they don't go everywhere, but it's like, if they're making an appearance, they have, like, different masks for, like, eating and different masks for doing, you know, whatever. They have, like, this is now my appearance mask. This is my eating mask. I'm going to dinner in this mask. So I don't know. I love that kind of commitment to character throughout your entire life. It's pretty great.
Right. I mean, have you ever seen any pictures? I believe it was when Blue Demon died, the way they shut down Mexico City. I mean, it was, I mean, you talk about like a rich kind of pop culture icon.
I mean, man.
I mean, the whole city shut down for his funeral. I mean,
they're living superheroes. They're living, you know, heroes. They're incredible.
Absolutely. I mean, they're like, I mean, I just can't even think of like an American equivalent of something like that where it's, you know, everything would stop, you know, like you said, like real life. It's
Schwarzenegger, Hulk Hogan, and I don't know, Katherine Hepburn rolled up into one. I don't know.
Right.
they're all things to all people. They embody everything.
Right. Because if you looked at pictures of Blue Demon's funeral compared to John F. Kennedy's, it's about the same level of you know, respect being paid. It's amazing.
Yeah, definitely. They have the horses drawn and
that's crazy.
Junior was sitting there saluting.
Right.
Blue Demon Junior.
Right.
I mean,
for those of us not in the know,
Not JFK Jr. He didn't make it down.
No. He might have. We don't know. You don't know.
Yeah.
He could have been a fan.
But a side note about the sad tragedy of JFK Jr.'s passing. I was at work the night he took off in the plane from Caldwell Airport in New Jersey and in the horrible storm and then never, you know, maybe.
Oh my lord. You were at the, you worked
at? I was at work, right? In my office, literally, I looked out the window at that airport every day when I was at work. So I actually, I'm sitting there, when I heard that he took off, I was like, well, no shit. That was the worst storm I've been sitting there watching in ages. I can't believe somebody flew in that, you know? And, but seriously, that was kind of crazy. I'll never forget, like, the next day when it came out and I was like, wow, somebody was flying in that? You know, like, you know, it just was crazy. But so that's a weird aside that has absolutely nothing to do with anything we're talking about today, except for the word junior. That's literally the only thing I have to know. So, but if I could rein myself back in, one of the things that we do with this podcast a little bit is Blaine and I are both Christians who grew up in the church. I am currently not a church goer, but I am a believer. I'm a pastor's kid, and Blaine is a churchgoer, a little bit, maybe a little bit more devout than me in that regard. But we like to talk a little bit about the implications of the films that we discuss in our faith. And one of the things that jumped out at me about all three of these films thematically was that there's a lot of really interesting living in the gray. As far as like, not in the black and white. There's a lot of, like, where the morality or ethics are questionable. You know, our lead characters who even do good things are also living kind of shitty lives. And I think that that's really interesting in regards to looking at how we live our lives, as well as all three of these stories dealing a little bit in redemption. So I think those were kind of things that I jumped out at me. And I just wanted to kind of throw that out there.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, I'm not religious, but we were talking about one of the writers and I were kind of talking about how, like, it's a rough movie. Low Life is obviously a rough movie, but it's all like a very like moral universe by the end of it. Like everybody gets what they deserve, you know, which is a really, and I do think it's almost like the world gets righted by the end. And obviously like they have to go on kind of the worst journey through hell ever. And, you know, we literally say in the movie, like, welcome to hell, like they're going down into hell. But then from that, you know, their little pocket right. of the world is kind of made right again, you know.
Definitely. And I mean, I talked about Randy's end, and I think that that's a really good, interesting redemption story in itself. And how he is involved in that. I think all the characters, you're right, kind of get their good and bad. Yeah, they're for good and bad. There's a morality there. And, you know, and I definitely see that. That's a really interesting, and whether intentional or not. And one of the things that kind of started me in this podcast is the fact that, like, a lot of the quote-unquote Christian world is unwilling to deal with a lot of the themes that something like Low Life does. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's such a mistake, because I think that that's, like, how are you supposed to, you know, learn the life that, you know, we're supposed to if we're reading, you know, a Bible or being taught this stuff, if we're not actually dealing with those topics. So I think that's, you know, just to put it in perspective, that's why I always kind of have this eye, especially when watching darker, fringier kind of cinema, that I'm always mm-hmm. kind of looking at that kind of stuff and wondering why I'm drawn to such stuff, you know, because I am.
Yeah, I think that's a cool. Films. No, that's a really cool, like, way into it. And I do think that it's important to kind of, like, yeah, see sort of all sides of society and not just kind of what you want to narrowly right. are comfortable with. So, yeah, that's definitely commendable.
Yep. Blaine, is there anything thematically that jumped out at you besides what I hit or in regards to what I hit there?
Well, I mean, I think you hit it. I mean, with all the movies we watched, there is this sort of, this sort of redemption story. Like, even, like, when you watch Alfredo Garcia, in the end of that movie, when he kind of gets that, that kind of righteous indictment at the end, it's amazing how, like, he ends up killing, like, everybody. I mean, like,
everybody.
It doesn't make any sense that he makes it out as far as he does. But, I mean, I think all these films kind of cover that, like you said, like, that gray area where people aren't—they're navigating a real world sort of existence where there's not always right and wrong. It's not like, you know, a white hat and a black hat cowboys facing off against each other. And Low Life deals with a lot of things, you know, on a social level that I think is really interesting. And like, we keep skirting around all the main points, but we don't want to ruin anything for the viewers, and just glad that we got a chance to talk about all three of these films.
Definitely. Yeah, I think, like, even to that point, like, I rewatching Wild at Heart this time and kind of reading into it a little bit more, reading up about it a bit more, I didn't know that, you know, that was kind of not initially supposed to be the original ending of them getting together. Like, I think the book that he based it on, and then the original, I think they even shot it, was like, you know, it's when they part, and then it turns into like a super Hollywood movie where he's like jumping over, you know, cars to get back with her and for them to reunite. But, like, you know, they ended it with them splitting up, and I was thinking about that, like, with Low Life, like, we actually had more of a downer ending, and it wasn't until we were shooting and kind of talking about it, and, you know, when we shot specifically the scene with what happens to how Dan ends up, Crystal's husband, we were really like,
that was a tough one to watch.
Yeah, and it was like, in shooting that, I was like, man, we can't end the movie how we're ending it now, where they didn't get together in the end, you know. And it was just like, that's just not a, so I felt like kind of, and I probably wouldn't have when I was younger. Again, we were talking about, like, when you're younger and you don't really get life as much, you know, like, I really understood, like, what Lynch kind of was hanging on to there, where he was like, this isn't the ending, you know, like, the ending is these two have to get together after they've been through all this. I do think that that's like kind of that nagging sort of like we want like a, you know, a satisfying ending, and either some kind of like redemption or moral sort of like sort of wrap up. Then I think a lot of times stuff can kind of come off, you know, a little bit more glib, or like, hey, we're just, this is how we're ending the movie because, you know, it's a cool ending or whatever, and it's not, yeah, it's not satisfying emotionally.
Definitely, so. And I think in a way you need that element of hope, and you know, I mean, like I reviewed and have watched now I think 20 times probably in a year, not really, probably five. Get Out. I probably watched Get Out 5 times already, besides the time I was in the theater. So. And I absolutely love the film. But when listening to Jordan Peele talk about the original ending and the ending they went with as well, which everybody could easily find out, that it was a much more glib ending, a much darker ending, and perhaps more realistic in a way. But
yeah, definitely.
But that said, I think that what he pointed out that I think was awesome was that he said, you know, one of the things that that artists can do and people can do a lot of times that can be a disservice is not let people hope. And he said he wanted there to be a glimmer of hope. He wanted it to, you know, especially in the times we're dealing with right now that we've hinted at a whole bunch of times here, you know, hope needs to be there. We need hope.
100%. Yeah, and that was really important with me and Low Life was, you know, it was like going as low as you can and making like the stakes really high and it's horrible, but you don't want to wallow it in either. And you do want to have, you know, that piece of like, man, these guys can survive this if they work together, you know, and if they actually like come together against this, you know, evil white man. So hopefully we'll see that real change in the world soon enough.
With a very similar haircut, as we pointed out.
Exactly.
Awesome. Hey, well, before we go, one of the things we do typically do is, and we'll definitely end with encouraging you to plug a little bit of where people can find you. But before we do that, Blaine and I like to kind of give our listeners a recommendation of something they can check out. To follow up, it doesn't necessarily have to be related to what we just talked about. It could be. Are there any films that you've gotten to see over these last couple festivals and stuff that you'd want to say, hey, people should really make an effort to check this one out?
Unfortunately, I have not gotten a chance to see a single movie at one of these festivals because we're like busy doing stuff. Yeah, no, it's terrible. But I really, there are a couple that I really do want to see, so I'm sure maybe you guys have seen them. Let's see, we were Tragedy Girls.
I enjoyed that quite a bit. Yeah
same here.
Yeah, so I'd say Tragedy Girls because I've heard really good things about it but have not got a chance to see it, so it may not be good at all. I'm not recommending it in the least bit.
Your recommendation is strictly in the fact that you've heard it's good. But don't blame me if it's not.
Yeah, and it looks cool, and I like what it's, you know, what it seems to be doing. So I don't know. It looks like a good time. And then I don't know. Let's see. There's not really.
Or just anything else that you've seen recently, or maybe not even seen recently, but just something that you know you've been coming back to that you'd want to recommend. I'll give you a couple minutes to think about it while Blaine and I give a couple recommendations here.
Okay.
So Blaine, do you have anything popping off that you wanted to recommend to folks?
Oh yeah, I've got something. I wanted to just kind of with talking about these films and film festivals and things. I finally got a chance to see the new Alejandro Jodorowsky film, Endless Poetry. I know we had talked about it a little bit a few weeks ago, but right. I finally got a chance to see it and. I was absolutely floored. I wasn't a big fan of the last one, but I really enjoyed it. I mean, I think he did a good job of kind of capturing what it's like being, you know, in that kind of late teens, early 20s, and trying to figure out the world. So I just wanted to touch on that. I didn't really have anything too related.
No, that's a great one.
But yeah, no, I was absolutely fucking floored, and it really wants me. Now I want to go back and watch through the last that I didn't care as much for. But yeah, so
same with me. I'm planning on going back to watch Dance of Reality for the same reason. I also found the Endless Poetry to be a superior film. And I also think I would note that I think it might be the most accessible film he's ever made. For people who are not exactly more mainstream type film fans, who might not be Jodorowsky ready, it might be an interesting way in. So that's just my thought.
Yeah, I kind of think, I mean, by no means am I saying you're wrong, but I kind of think the opposite. This one is, to me, is like one of, to me, reminds me a lot more of like Holy Mountain and everything. It's like, if Holy Mountain was an autobiography, like, I don't know, this one to me is just so bizarre, and it's so steeped in like making sure that you've seen Holy Mountain, that you've seen Santa Sangre. That's where I think it might just be gibberish if you're not like up on
up on
its language. Right. So I mean, but like I said, neither right or wrong. But yeah, I just wanted to push that one. I'm sure it's going to be getting a release soon. I know they keep raising $1 zillion on Indiegogo with the project, so it should be out soon for at least U.S. audiences. So yeah, that's
a recommendation. It's actually got a very limited theatrical already.
Oh,
very
did it?
Limited right now. Yeah, very limited, but it's out for about 2 weeks now.
Oh shit! I didn't know that at all.
It's probably only in big cities, to be honest. By big cities, I mean like L.A. and New York. It might literally only be in L.A. But there are plans, I think, for it to go a little wider. So hopefully it gets that push. But I think that's a great recommendation. I would go with, for me, I guess just, you know, here's an interesting one. In that it has nothing to do with anything we've been talking about, but I really enjoyed, there's a documentary, I actually saw two really good documentaries recently, but I'm going to highlight one of them. I'm a punk rock kid, you know that, always will be, and Turn It Around, the Story of East Bay Punk, which was produced by Green Day. It's about that East Bay scene. I thought it was extremely well done, and someone who... you know, is in my mid-30s, that early 90s punk explosion that kind of came out of East Bay is something that is really, like, near and dear to me. So I really, really appreciated that. And the other documentary, which just people should keep their eyes out for, is 30 Years of Garbage, the Garbage Pail Kid story, because the Garbage Pail Kid is shit, so...
No, I've been really wanting to see that Garbage Pail Kid's doc.
it's pretty dope, so... So Ryan, do you have any other ones you wanted to go to hit up, or do you want to just look where people can find you?
I don't really have like anything super new. I mean, the two movies that, like you said, keep going back to recently are I've been watching, I guess, Revenge, that German film from like mid-2000s. I don't know if you've seen that, but it's like a crime film. It's incredible. And I've been watching that a lot, just kind of thinking about my next stuff, just tone-wise and everything. It's a really great movie. It's on Criterion, no big deal. So it's, you know, it's good.
Right.
Yeah. And Nightcrawler, I watched that kind of, and that even, I feel like some of that kind of steeped into, obviously, or seeped into Low Life as well. Like gnarly LA life, you know, is really, that's a, I don't know.
One day I'll get to make.
You never seen Nightcrawler?
No.
No, you never.
Oh wow. Wow.
I know, right? I've had a copy since it was released, and it's just I just haven't watched it. I don't know why.
You gotta watch it, man. It's such a smart movie. Like, it's like so well done.
All right, I got homework. I'll watch that before.
No, that's awesome.
Yeah, and then yeah, just I don't know. Plug wise. I mean, I'm on all the social media, just Ryan Prowse, P-R-O-W-S, my last name, and I have a website as well, but yeah,
we'll link that stuff up, no doubt.
Okay, cool.
Do you have any updates on the actual film, if it's going to get a theatrical, a small, large, what do you got going with that?
We're still in the middle of trying to sell it, so no promises there, but... it's looking good. And then, like I said, I'm doing this little mini Euro tour, so I'm really excited about that. And hopefully, we don't have our American premiere fest yet. figure it out, or I think they're almost kind of figuring it out. So hopefully we can announce that soon. And then
I think it should be the Buried Alive Festival in Atlanta, but that's just me.
Yeah.
Oh shit.
I mean, I know a guy who's programming that festival. He happens to be my co-host to this this podcast, so you know.
Oh, okay.
Awesome. Yeah, well, thanks so much, Ryan. I really appreciate everything.
No, this is awesome. This is a really great
going on. Yeah.
I appreciate the your guys' reviews on Farsighter were really great. I appreciate the kind words there on the film.
No, and thanks thanks for coming out and talking to us today, man. It's been a lot of fun.
Dope.
All right, awesome. Well, hey, thank you everybody, and stick around. We'll be coming back here shortly. And we'll see you next time. Peace.
Do you have a motherfucking swastika tattoo on your face?
Here we go.
Damn, G.
Amigos, bienvenidos al
Take heed, my friend.